Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I just want to say to you all that some notes I've gotten here about what you want to ask. Mr. Bernstein, we are arranging to have the state's attorney come on again for a longer conversation, which he said he would do. He had a tight schedule today. He had a half an hour. We will schedule an hour-long conversation if we can more with him. We see your tweets coming in now about the state's attorney, and what I will do is save these tweets, use them for the next conversation, and when you wrote about increasing independence and transparency of investigations, I think that that's something that he does want to talk about, that he said as he was leaving here, and we'll come back and raise those issues with him when we bring him back. So I just want to let you all know that. It was actually a real schedule that didn't allow him to be more than a half an hour, but it's been a while, and so we wanted to get him on for at least that time. We are now about to talk to Ann Hornaday, who for many years was a guest on the show consistently, and we hope that will start happening again. She's a film critic for The Washington Post. Ann, good to see you.
It's great to see you. Thanks for having me. Fine. How are you?
I'm great.
You're always great.
So, folks, you can join us. Film this time.
Yeah.
410-319-8888 is number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com and log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is our number. Of course, I saw the piece you wrote about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, yes. Yeah. What a blow. And the inbox, I was really amazed at the my inbox has just been full. People are really knocked over by this. I think he affected so, you know, Nora Ephron once said the last thing you know is your effect. And this is such a case of that. I wish, you know, I wish he had known how many people he moved and touched because he clearly did.
Now, he's an amazing actor. And I think one of the things that we'll talk about in another segment is just I hope that the one thing is out of his death is that people begin to realize that people who are addicted are not criminals.
Yes,
as
indeed.
We lock up millions of men, mostly men of color in this country, because
exactly.
They have the same addiction that he had.
Exactly. And they're also not tortured. You know, in the piece that I wrote, I kind of wanted to examine this notion of the tortured artist, you know, because I think
right.
When we lose people like a Philip Seymour Hoffman or a Heath Ledger, you know, to drugs, I think we kind of go to a default mode about talking about demons and people who are just too sensitive for this world. And I think that that's an understandable rhetoric because
mm-hmm.
we want to be compassionate and
mm-hmm.
we want to be respectful of their gifts. But I think that that language isn't really useful. And I don't think it's necessarily, I think this is, like you said, it's a public health issue.
It is.
It's a disease. It's a public health issue. Let's take it out of those contexts that we tend to obscure it in or mystify it in.
And I've had a lot of friends in my life who were junkies.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them were some of the most sensitive people I knew. Some of the brightest, most sensitive people I knew were people who
mm-hmm.
were strung out on heroin. And that's just real.
But there's plenty who aren't, you know. I mean,
right.
It's represented across the – and I think it's a problem beyond the creative centers of New York and L.A. and Baltimore. You know, it's a problem everywhere, and I think you're right. The sooner that we organize it as a public health situation and manage it that way, the better off everybody will be.
Let me ask you this. I've been a lot all the stuff you've been writing over the last few months, and
I do gas on, don't I?
Yeah. You can write on. You do write a lot, which is good. Good. I mean, we need a film critic.
Luckily, I have editors.
and Valerie and I have been seeing a lot of movies,
mm,
as much as we can, to kind of see what we think when these Oscars come
yes.
up. We're going to do our post-Oscar show with
yes.
you and a couple of others.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I look at the difference between how people are nominated in different you know, whether it's the Golden Globes or Oscars, and I was looking last night at the SAG Awards,
mm-hmm.
the Screen Actors Guild Awards, and when you look at the Screen Actors Guild Awards, they made more sense to me,
mm-hmm.
just in terms of what they were looking at. I mean, when they looked at the shows, they had American Hustle, 12 Years a Slave, August, Osage County, Dallas Buyers Club, and The Butler, which
okay.
I agree, I think are five of the most outstanding films,
mm-hmm.
at least from my perspective,
right.
were made this year.
Yeah. And well acted. I mean, beautifully acted.
All well acted.
Right.
All well acted. And I was thinking about the difference between something like American Hustle and 12 Years a Slave, which we had had a debate on this in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Both of which I thought were incredible movies.
Mm-hmm.
12 Years, the American Hustle was just one of those extremely well acted, shot, funny, movies that just drew you in. You stayed with it. Great story. Mm-hmm. Great little mystery. But 12 Years a Slave, what hit me about that movie, a lot like Fruitvale Station, mm-hmm. those two movies this year, to me, those were breakthrough movies
yeah.
in terms of what they did for film that has not been done before.
I take your point, and I think you're right. And I think, yeah, when we're sort of comparing these things, it is really apples and oranges, because you're right. American Hustle succeeds at what it sets out to do. You know, it's very entertaining and it's very engaging. It's just a heck of a lot of fun to watch. But I agree that I think 12 Years a Slave is just a great work of art. I mean, I think that it not only the story that it tells and the myth that it's correcting, you know, of the Moonlight Magnolias, you know, gone with the, you know, when you think right. of the narrative tradition of the Deep South and the slavery era South in cinema, you know, it's not a pretty history. And I think so the movie's important even for that. But just beyond those things, it's just a great piece of visual and aural storytelling and artistry. I mean, I just think he's a true artist, Steve McQueen, the director. I mean, the way he juxtaposes sound and image, and performance and dialogue, you know, those kind of conventional elements of a movie. But I just think it transcends those to become a great work of art. And I think Fruitvale Station was a masterpiece as well. I mean, I just thought, especially for a first-time film.
Oh, my God.
I mean, just an absolutely... and I think both kind of transcended their immediate subjects to hand. You know, they told very specific stories, but just in a way that makes them utterly universal and timeless and... Yeah, I just can't say enough about him.
I am, and also the screenwriter, Ridley.
Oh, and let me just say, I saw 12 Years a Slave. John Ridley wrote 12. It was the screenwriter for 12 Years
right.
a Slave. I saw that at the Toronto Film Festival, and it blew me and everybody else away. He's directed a movie about Jimi Hendrix
yes.
called All Is By My Side, and we.
You saw it?
I saw it. It was the last movie I saw at Toronto. I kind of wandered in. It hadn't been getting very much buzz. And I thought, oh, and I even, to the point where I even felt like people were kind of shrugging about it, like, it's not that great. It blew my mind. It is so, again, the way he uses image, he didn't have the rights to Hendrix's music because the family has been very protective of those songs. So he, and Andre 3000 plays Hendrix beautifully. And
that's what they do for the music.
They wrote original music in the style of, and I'll tell you, it works.
Wow!
It's a very impressionistic. We'll come back on. I'll come back on and talk about it when it comes back. I hope it comes. I'm sure it'll come out this year. But this is a real talent.
Yeah, I tried to find the movie last night, but you can't. It's not.
No, it's not out yet.
There.
Nope, there's nothing yet. I want to find out. I'm bird dogging this one because it just transported me. I thought it was just brilliant.
And they composed their own music in the style.
Yeah,
of
I think that's my. That's I think they might have used a couple of other extant songs, you know, that weren't Hendrix songs. But yeah, if I understood correctly, I think they composed their own music.
You know, the other thing that hit me about with how some of these awards go before I kind of hit some of your writing is that when they looked at kind of the best. Female actor in supporting roles. The fact that Oprah didn't get it.
Oh, I know. That was a disappointment.
She was absolutely brilliant.
I agree.
In The Butler.
I agree.
Jennifer Lawrence was brilliant. Julia Roberts was brilliant.
I know.
Lupita
yes.
Nyong'o was
yeah.
brilliant. They were all brilliant.
Yeah. True, but Oprah Winfrey blew me away. I was not expecting. It was like, it's to the point now where it's like, is there anything she can't do? And she had to age. I mean, she went from a young woman to an old, you know, it's just the physical challenge of it, the physical transformation, but the honesty. I mean, it was just,
yes.
you believed that woman, you believed, you know, you were there 100%. It was, I even thought, my biggest apprehension going into The Butler was the president's, you know, sort of like, is this going to be a little bit cheesy?
Right.
But I actually thought, I mean, there were a few that I thought didn't work, but for the most part, I thought they worked beautifully. I thought the conceit was very gracefully done. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was a fan of that film as well.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I thought he did a brilliant job.
And one of the few times we've really seen the breadth of the civil rights movement. I mean, I've written about this over the years, which is that we've never really had that epic, definitive, Gandhi-esque movie depicting, representing the American Civil Rights Movement. And I know Taylor Branch, you know, has tried to get Parting the Waters. You know, that has been in development over the years for a very long time. It's a, you know, it's a huge challenge. But and I, you know, obviously we've seen it depicted as a backdrop. We've seen sort of, you know, Mississippi Burning, which had its problems.
Yes, it did.
We've had to understate the case. But we just haven't seen that scope. And I think that this is the first film I've seen at it, if not in a long time at all, that really tried to get at that that morphology of the movement, you know, from sort of in terms of how it evolved. And I really appreciated that.
It was like zealot of the civil rights.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought, yeah,
passing through.
It was hugely valuable. I think that's a thing of value.
Oh,
I really do.
I do, too. And I just say, one of the things that hit me about movies so far this year is it has been the acting. I mean, I've just been blown away by people I've seen in all these films, whether it's August Osage County or Fruitvale Station or 12 Years a Slave or Enough Said, Captain Phillips. They're just...
It was a year, I'll tell you.
Philomena?
Yes, I know. The little ones and the big ones. It was a great year for movies. It really was. I mean, especially that last, those last few months when they... You know, and that's keyed to award season, and that's these movies are kind of made in order to be released in a way that the award season can garner awareness for them without the studios having to spend a whole lot of money. Although I think they do spend a lot of money on the campaigns awards,
the
award campaigns. But be that as it may, if that's what it takes to get these things made, fine. I mean, I just think if that's how it's what it means is though that the year is backloaded, you know, so that we tend to get the really best stuff all at once, you know, in that 2 or 3 month period. And so, you know, people with lives and jobs and kids don't have time to go see these movies every weekend, you know. So it would be nice if we could somehow find a way to, you know, rediscover the other 9 months of the year so that we could have these wonderful things a little every month. But it was a really stellar movie year.
A lot of people end up... We all end up watching on television these days because it's just...
That's the way of the world. That's the world we live in.
The popcorn is cheaper.
Yes. And, you know, when people are talking, at least you know them.
Right. Shut up.
Yes, exactly. You can say shut up. And maybe they will.
Put it on pause.
There you go.
Let me see that again.
No, you're right. And actually, I'm proud to say that the Washington Post last summer, we started reviewing on demand for that very reason, because there is such a plethora of good material, much of which ends up on Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime. And in markets like Baltimore and even Washington, it might end up there rather than theaters. We may not get something in a theater and only get it on demand. And those are worthy, good movies that deserve to be lifted up. So we've decided to start reviewing them in their own right because, you know, it used to be that if something went straight to on demand, it was deemed a little bit less than. But that's not the case anymore. Perfectly good material. As a matter of fact, 12 O'Clock Boys is one of the best examples of that.
The document you made here in
Baltimore. I just reviewed that last week for on demand because we didn't get that in theaters in Washington. You got it in theater. We got it in theaters here in Baltimore.
Because the film festival here in Baltimore.
Exactly. But we did not get it in a theater in Washington. So I that's a brilliant movie.
So what do you? That's an interesting question, though. I'm curious. We have a lot of people who listen to this program will call in or talk to me about movies they're making. The independent filmmakers. There's a lot of that going on. There was a film festival here last weekend that I unfortunately couldn't get to, but the Griot Festival, where all these young people's films were being shown.
It's wonderful.
12-minute pieces, longer pieces, kids from the city doing documentaries and dramatic films. And
excellent.
Really amazing stuff that young people are doing here in Baltimore.
Excellent.
In programs and on their own.
Yeah.
And so, because I think that there's a morphing taking place. There's a shift in the world of movie making.
Yeah.
I remember a quote from Robert Redford where he said he wanted to focus on backing movies and helping movies be made that are short movies that can be watched on our devices.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that is. That's how we are. That's how we're apprehending our culture now. That's where it is. And I think that's fantastic. That's really exciting. And it's also really necessary. I just think because we're living in such a media-saturated environment that it's not only important for creative expression and it's fun and it's exciting, but it's a really crucial piece of media literacy. And I think young people have to, you know, I think media literacy is just as important now as the three R's in terms of being able to unpack images, unpack messages, understand, you know, to be really fluent in the ways of visual storytelling, not only as practitioners but as consumers, so that you can be sophisticated viewers and understand what, you know, what these pieces are trying to sell us or tell us.
Right.
Or
right.
You know, I just think it's crucial more than ever how to unpack violence, you know, how to, you know, these anxiety. I think a lot of people have anxieties around screen violence, and I think media literacy is the answer, not censorship. Or you know, that we can talk about the rating system and tweaking that, but I really think being sophisticated viewers is the best answer.
And I think you keep
and making your work, making media is a big part of that, because when you make it, you understand the intention that's behind it.
I mean, for young people to learn how to make media.
Exactly.
I do think that's important. I mean, because I think that there's this constant battle going on between there are people who are going to make these giant Hollywood movies, and that's their world, and it's not an easy world to break into, but some people might stumble into it. And
yes.
And
it happens.
It happens.
Yeah.
People know somebody, they get into it. But yeah. A lot of incredible work can be done on a much smaller level.
Agreed.
And different ways of marketing it, different ways of having it seen.
Oh, agreed. And people now we all have our own followings on Facebook and Twitter. So
right.
There's your audience right there. You know, we're all bringing our own built-in communities. And so, yeah, you're right. We don't have to depend on the gatekeepers anymore.
So anything like that you've seen that really grabs you?
Ooh, oh. Darn, you caught me flat-footed.
Sorry.
I know. I'm sure when I walk out, I'll think of it. I mean, unfortunately, the best part of my job is I get to see so many movies, but the worst part is I see so many movies. You know, I'm usually seeing the more mainstream stuff. Yeah, they do a little bit. And then I do, because of the structure of my job, I'm focusing more on the Hollywood stuff, the stuff that will be coming out of mainstream. So I'm probably not as in touch with the grassroots independent scene as I would want to be.
There's a film that I've been reading about that I really want to see. That here I have my notes and I can't find them. But he's a Palestinian filmmaker.
Mm.
The one who made the film about the guy who is being accused of being a collaborator.
Yes. Well, there's, you know, it's interesting because there's a couple. There's one called Omar, which is coming
out
soon.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And then there's another one called Bethlehem, which is uncannily similar in terms of the structure. You know, and it's, speaking of the gatekeepers, I'm sure, did you see the documentary The Gatekeepers last year?
Yes.
Having seen that, that was, of course, about the Shin Bet Security Agency, and the filmmaker interviewed all living leaders of the Shin Bet to talk about their work in the Palestinian territories, occupied territories, and how they surveilled the Palestinian community, how they tried to stop terrorist attacks, and how they, you know, how they kind of evolved politically on the issue of the occupation. And so watching these movies through that lens, you know, these guys, almost to a man, were incredibly progressive. I mean, they were all, you know, land for peace people pretty much by the end of that movie, regardless of how hawkish
right.
they were. And I feel like with Omar, I need to see it again. I saw it several months ago at a festival, but it's a little schematic in terms of how it sets up the relationship between the Palestinian young man and the officer who's working with him as a resource. And I wish it had been maybe just a little more nuanced. And of course, I'm such an optimist. I like to end on a little note of hope, even though I know that
it's hard to make hopeful movies.
It is about that context. But yeah, it's exciting to see so much work coming out of that part of the world.
I mean, what, you know, I was when watching some TV the other night, we were watching the Super Bowl and watching these commercials. Most of them I think were terrible, but what I did notice about the commercials is the power of the creative mind that goes into those commercials.
Mm.
Numbers of people who can't kind of make a living in other parts of the creative world, so they end up in the advertising
yes.
industry making commercials.
True.
Some are brilliantly creative and very funny and very poignant. And I started thinking about all the people, the numbers of people out here doing just that kind of work
yeah.
on their own. And whether it's these Palestinian filmmakers or people in our city here in Baltimore City or in any country around the globe, there's a lot of work going on.
It's really I feel like people are just compelled to tell their stories, you know, and with digital filmmaking tools that are relatively affordable, they can do it. And now, you know, what's interesting is what you said is these new is how are we going to find these distribution channels to whether it's on demand or just through people's, you know, links on websites, streaming on websites. I mean, the comedian Louis C.K. he made a film in the 90s that just never got distributed, never went. I mean, it played festivals, but it never played theaters. He just put it on his website and he's selling it for $5. So that's going to be interesting, you know, to see this kind of circuit be completed. Because there is a lot of material being created. It's just the question is then what? I mean, because there is a little bit, it does create a bottleneck. But it's thrilling. I mean, this isn't really a grassroots project necessarily, but there's a documentary called The Square about the events in Tahrir Square. And Jahan Nujaim made it, who's an established filmmaker. But still, really, it could have been, you know, it's a guerrilla production. I mean, she had this very lightweight digital camera. It's very similar, actually, to what Lotfi Nathan did with 12 O'Clock Boys in terms of just this equipment that could get you into the action easily. And she just plunged herself into Tahrir Square and came out with this gorgeous film that is really enlightening.
You wrote about that film.
I reviewed it.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, again, these are all ways to illuminate. I mean, I think we read the newspaper and we read about these far-off stories that seem overwhelming and seem impossible to comprehend. And these movies really do give us some context and almost a symbolic language, you know, with which to understand otherwise obscure issues.
So I'm curious what you've seen coming down the pike that you really have been excited about recently.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm thrilled with. I really think that one of the big stories of last year was, and this is something that we talked about a few shows ago, was just this. I really do think it's a high water point for African American filmmaking and storytelling and in across genres. Now we're seeing this great sort of. You know, diversity is sort of an overused word, but there is this diversity of types of stories being told, styles in which they're being told. Mm-hmm. We are being introduced to these wonderful actors like Lupita Nyong'o and Michael B. Jordan, whom I know a lot of people know, but they're now being vaunted into the mainstream. We have filmmakers like Dee Reese and Ava DuVernay and Ryan Coogler. I'm John Ridley. It's such a relief. I mean, you don't know. Well, I think often one general audiences don't know what they're missing until, you know, they see it and it's like, oh, of course, you know.
And when you said Ryan Coogler, I mean, I interviewed Ryan and
wonderful guy, young man,
young guy who comes from the neighborhood that he talked about.
That's right.
Grew up there, went to film school.
Oh,
and he's
just a lot of integrity.
Amazing, and Michael, who starred in the film. You said his name.
Michael Jordan,
mm-hmm. Who was in The Wire.
Yes, indeed. Right. So he's known to Wire fans, but not to the. But he just was stunning, stunning. Everyone in the film was stunning.
And to me, that whole film was like this exposition of working class life.
Exactly.
In that you don't see.
That's right.
You've never seen before. You don't see it.
Yes.
The power of love and family that was surrounding this world.
That's right. And that's what I think these film. Everyone I mentioned, Ava DuVernay, Dee Reese, they're all doing that. They're all kind of. I actually talked to Ava about this last year, about like that blind spot we seem to have in terms of just depicting working class and middle class black life. And I think The Butler did that. Was one of the what I loved about The Butler and Fruitvale Station were the home scenes, you know, just people living their lives and like you said, nurturing family and loving each other. And at one point, Lee Daniels suggested to me that he thought that little tiny scene where Oprah Winfrey and Forrest Whitaker send their son off to college to Fisk, he said that might be the first scene we've seen of a black family sending a kid off, you know, at the bus, you know, that kind of typical scene that we all take for granted in films about white people. That might be the first time we've seen that.
Right.
Or if it isn't the first, it sure is the first in a too long of a time.
I can't remember one. I thought about that when you talked about it before. I couldn't even think of one.
So I am just thrilled. I'm really, I just feel like we're we passed some kind of watershed last year that was palpable to me.
And we passed another watershed today.
We did.
You're back on the air.
Here I am.
Good.
Thrilled.
Anne Hornaday, Washington Post film critic. We'll see you right after the Oscars.
You bet.
I'll talk to you on that. You'll be with us in some form.
I think so. I think I might be here in person.
That would be even better.
Okay.
All right.
Wherever you want me, I'll be.
All right, good.
Tell me where to go.
Anne Hornaday, great to see you. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here, Mark. Thank you.
And folks, we're going to take a break. And as we go out, we're going to be listening to Blackbird by Donald Byrd. He passed, one of the great trumpeters who passed away on this day last year. And share a bit of that. We come back. It's time for Sound Bites and our look at the world of food, new food, farming, and our environment. Stay with us.